Welcome to the Daily Canon Podcast.
Hello again, listeners. It's another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast. I think this may be the 162nd Daily Canon Weekly Podcast, which really does reflect our commitment to you, the listener. And yes, introducing our new special guest, who's making himself heard. But before we get on to that, joining me in an official capacity this week, we have Sylvain Jamet. How are you, Sylvain?
Oh, very good, thank you.
And Helen Trantum, how are you, and how is your special guest?
I'm very well, thank you. And he is apparently very excited to be making his debut as the very youngest junior gunner on the Daily Canon podcast.
So apologies for any interesting sound effects you get, listeners, but then this is in a very good cause. You see, as some of you may already know, Helen is married to a Spurs fan, and so this is trying to save the next generation from such a horrible, horrible fate, although at the moment perhaps they're feeling a little bit more positive about it than the last 30 years. Anyway, we don't want to be talking about them unless we're laughing at them.
I was thinking that, Matthew, when you said it's the 162nd podcast, I was thinking that's about how many years it's been since Spurs last won anything, isn't it?
Well, I mean, certainly 60-something does seem appropriate. Obviously, one day Spurs might win the league in the era of colour television, although by then we'll probably be watching 3D surround colour TV on Mars or something. But anyway, without wasting any more time, we have a win, ladies and gentlemen. We have won a game, the first victory of the Unai Emery era, as all the papers were very happy to bang on about. How was it for you guys?
Underwhelming.
Fair.
It was a bit odd, really, because in many ways we actually played worse than we had against City or Chelsea.
Well, yeah, I suppose against both City and Chelsea we were facing teams that to a certain degree wanted to come at us and compete to control the game, which is something we struggled with, whereas West Ham were playing a more counter-attacking style, weren't they?
Yeah, well, you often hear about teams that raise their game to based on who they're playing against. You don't quite so often hear about teams who lower their game to match their opposition, but we had a darn good go at it, I thought, on Saturday.
Well, the passing, particularly in the first half, was a bit...
basics. I thought Guendouzi was a microcosm of the entire team. You know, I thought he played pretty well, obviously raw, making a few... slight errors against Chelsea and City, but on the whole, the overall performance was pretty good. And then against West Ham, it was like we'd forgotten how to kick his leg through the ball so that the pass went where he intended it, as opposed to out of play or straight to an opposition player.
Well, I mean, at least we did see, because of that, further evidence of the Unai Emery willing to make substitutions before the 70th minute.
Yes. I'm not sure what I think of half-time substitutions, but yeah. It's nice when things are going wrong that you don't leave them to continue to go wrong.
I mean, it's definitely a change from Arsene Wenger on that side, so something good coming out of it.
I mean, where do you stand on half-time substitution, Sylvain?
I don't see it any problem, to be honest. I've seen manager making change after 20 minutes, and I would do them as well, so I don't think it's a problem at all.
Yes, I forgot, of course, you're a tactical fascist, so...
Yeah. If it goes wrong, you can change after 20 minutes.
Half-time substitutions is you've literally just had 15 minutes to tell everyone what you want to do, and then you're not going to give them any chance to do it before you complain it. Like, why wait till half-time if you think it needs changing? You know, if it needs changing, change it. Don't do it at 45 minutes, which is the one point in the game when you do get to say something without having to send on a player to convey your message for you.
It's a tricky one, isn't it, though? Because getting hooked at half-time is still seen as sort of more socially acceptable than getting hooked in the first half. So perhaps there's an element of taking that into account. I don't know.
I'm a bit sorry for Roby anyway.
Yeah, I think what happens if they get subbed at half-time, they get told straight when they go out. So they actually the sub knows what he's going to do. So it's not like... Actually, what I saw a trend is actually player coming in like on the 46 minutes, like 1 minute after halftime. I've seen it a few times recently. It's quite funny.
I suppose it's trying to ensure that the sub's fully warmed up, perhaps. You can't suddenly see spot a tactical change within a minute of the second half, one would assume. I mean, speaking of tactical changes, obviously the new regime has some, well, a lot of similarities, but also some fundamental differences. I mean, what do we make of those differences so far? Well, he's clearly got an opinion.
Well, I think the most obvious one is obviously playing out from the back, which I don't quite get why we're doing it with the players we have. Or at least I don't have an issue with playing out from the back, but I just don't understand why you would do it to the exclusion of all other options. By all means, if they're not pressing you particularly high or the opportunities there, play out from the back. But when you've got 3, 4, 5 opposition players pressing up, the best way to take advantage of that is surely to bypass them and stick it over the top of them. You know, I think that doesn't happen straight to the centre forward, which, you know, Aubameyang, for all his qualities, isn't particularly gifted in the air, despite his reasonably high stature. But it could be a strategically placed ball into the midfield or out the wings.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky one, because obviously, as we saw in one of the goals against Chelsea, when you play up from the back and you actually beat the press, it can be a very effective way of retaining controlled possession in dangerous areas, as opposed to longer balls, which obviously are harder to execute with the degree of precision that is required. I mean, I suppose the question is Unai Emery trying to do effectively what Guardiola did, which is impose certain principles, which are long-term plans, and find out which of the players can do it and which of them can't?
Well, it's a bit of a... you'd hope he'd have been able to do that in the sort of 2 months of training he had them before throwing them into a game. I mean, it was fairly obvious to me that Mustafi, for example, has got some ability but is completely reckless. You know, there's one moment in the first part, I think, where Cech passed the ball to Mustafi, and Mustafi thought he had about 3 hours on the ball. And just clearly sitting there thinking, oh, it's fine. Well, if anything goes wrong, I'll just pass it back to Cech. Turned to pass it back to Cech, who, guess what, had been closed down. And then he's turned and tried to hack it at Bellerin, only to lose the ball. You know, it was all born of his recklessness and his cockiness. It was overly casual, and that's not something that is exactly unusual to use to describe Mustafi, is it? And to me, that's just one of many. I still don't understand why we bought a new goalkeeper for quite a lot of money without actually playing him. Or indeed why we left the defensive midfielder with less technical ability on the bench.
I mean, Sylvain, you mentioned earlier on Slack that the differentiation between goalkeepers, didn't you?
Yeah, because obviously we also signed a French goalie for the women's side, and I've interviewed her recently. And she said it's definitely very different playing in England from playing on the continent. So I was thinking maybe Leno is not ready yet. I mean, I don't know, he's still in friendly, so Emery should know what Leno can do and what he cannot do. Actually, who signed Leno? Was it the guys before Emery? Or?
Well, they were linked with him for months before Emery was even joining the club, weren't they?
Ah, that's a problem, actually.
So we don't know if the manager rates the player.
You get, yeah. It's a bit of a problem if he doesn't fit the criteria.
Well, I mean, he should fit the criteria, really, simply because he's... you know, he is that modern goalkeeper who's very quick off his line, and okay, he's occasionally been burnt for Leverkusen making errors, but he is known for being quite good with the ball at his feet.
Well, you can't play a line that high without having a goalkeeper who can sweep up behind them. It's just nonsensical, suicidal. I mean, take your pick.
Yeah, it is that thing that the difficulty we have is we've got Cech is the technically better goalkeeper in terms of traditional goalkeeping skills, but is far less suited to playing with a high-line defence, because obviously he was so much of his career success was achieved at a Chelsea team that defended quite deep to try and protect both, you know, John Terry, for instance, and also Cech himself.
Yeah, but also all the traditional goalkeeping skills you mentioned, I just feel year on year deteriorate with Cech. And you know, where before there was a bit of a trade-off, I feel like now we're not getting much pro to go with the con.
I mean, I thought in the two games we've lost this season, I thought Cech was actually quite impressive in terms of every time the ball was not at his feet, but when he was having to use his hands. And there's certainly something to be said for the implication that there is more serious competition for his position than perhaps David Ospina was ever going to offer.
The biggest issue with playing it short, though, is the aforementioned Ospina. Because for years, I would say, I've been banging on about how we can't play the ball long because Ospina can't kick it far enough. And now we've apparently decided that no one can kick it far enough.
But Ospina couldn't even kick it in a straight line over short distances.
I mean, how Ospina ended up as a goalkeeper or even a football player, full stop, I don't quite understand. But that's...
Well, you know, it seems that the national managers of Colombia would disagree with you, and Ancelotti gave him a game for Napoli at the weekend. So, I mean, Ospina is what he is.
I can do a better job, and I'm 5'3". I'm an inch shorter than Ospina anyway, isn't it?
Well, you've probably...
I can catch.
You've probably got a similar neck length. I mean, looking at the options that we do have at our disposal, I mean, Sylvain, you obviously referred to the French goalkeeper that's joined the women's team. Did she go into any detail about what was so different about the game in France and in England?
Yeah, it's very physical in England. The referees are very lenient, and so the goalkeepers get kicked a lot more, and they get hit a lot more. So, I mean, it's.
But does that change how you play?
It's like, you know, on crosses in France or in Europe, you get a cross, the forward just charges you. You get a free kick. In England, you get nothing. Stuff like that.
Yeah, it's, I know, but you know, if you're going to come for the cross anyway, it doesn't altogether matter whether you're going to get the protection of the referee or not. You still go for it, don't you? It's only if it would change the decision-making that it becomes an issue.
Well, perhaps it does change the decision-making a little, because obviously, comparing our two goalkeepers of last season, I mean, Petr Cech was always going to be stronger in the air because that's always been a great strength of his goalkeeping. He's very tall and he's got very long arms, and his judgment on crosses has always been better than Ospina's.
Damning him with faint praise, I think, there.
But Bernd Leno is obviously... He's come from Germany, where the goalkeepers do get afforded a little more protection, but he's also had a couple of years where he's not been at the level of his previous career with Leverkusen. I mean, partly due to changes with the management, and at one point they sacked the goalkeeper coach. There was no specialist goalkeeper coach, which sounds like a great way to continue developing a young goalkeeper. And maybe there is concerns about that, but also he wasn't totally convincing in pre-season. But also, I suppose, one factor that we have to consider is that Cech is the captain at the moment in the absence of Lauren Koscielny. And if you don't make Cech the captain, who do you make captain? You've got Ramsey, who's...
Well, we've got five captains, Matthew.
We've got five captains.
They are, but we've got them, apparently. Well,
apparently we have, but I mean...
Is Jack one of them? Ozil?
Yeah. And given that Ramsey and Ozil have missed time each due to, or have had injury problems, and not necessarily, and we don't know if Ramsey's staying, and Ozil doesn't strike me as the most natural leadership material, particularly at this period of time when he's still probably dealing with the fallout of the World Cup. Maybe that's partly influencing the decision making. Maybe Petr Cech's in the team partly for the fact that he is the closest thing we have to an actual leader at the moment.
Mm-hmm. We know what I think is going to phase in Leno a bit later in the season, probably. So,
I hope so.
Cech starting, and when Cech starts making many mistakes, he's going to get subbed basically, and Leno will start games. I think that's what normally coaches do. You give a chance to the old guy, and then when you start making mistakes, shping, you get replaced.
Well, I suppose it's also that thing of we remember when Arsene Wenger bought Robert Pires, you know. He didn't start a game for about three matches because Wenger wanted to say, "Well, this is how this league works. Watch." And maybe there's an element of that as well. The kind of, you know, even though you'd think that the Bundesliga was slightly closer to the Premier League in terms of style, and Sorry, listeners, I've lost my train of thought. I've been distracted by a baby smiling at me, which is not something I can always say when recording this podcast. You'd have thought that the Bundesliga would lead to an easier transition, but, I mean, lest we forget, Petr Cech may not be the Petr Cech of 2007, 2006, but he's still a good goalkeeper. The question is about whether he fits in with this system, but I guess...
Yeah, but the problem is as well, you now said good goalkeeper, not great goalkeeper, and then not great, well, great, not world-class. You know, he's slowly climbing down the pegs. And I thought the best description I've read of it actually is, in three games, we've conceded, what, too many goals, like six goals.
Six goals, yeah.
And you can't look at them and say any of them are necessarily mistakes as such, but a better goalkeeper will still manage to keep one of them out on average.
Yeah, I mean, strange enough, I thought the weakest goal that Czechs conceded was actually the Arnautovic one, because...
just seemed a bit slow to react, didn't quite sprawl across quick enough, didn't get enough spring to the dive, you know?
I mean, that. Having said that, letting in slightly suspect goals from range has been a tradition at Arsenal ever since Pat Jennings. I mean, David Seaman's one weakness was long shots, particularly speculative ones. But even, you know...
If you look at the other end, you've got an ex-Arsenal goalkeeper keeping out, you know, a drive from Ramsey, for example, that I would suggest he caught rather better than the one Arnautovic scored. I know it was a bit further out...
But Fabianski was always a great shot stopper.
I don't say that's a mistake from Cech, but I still think that a better goalkeeper, you know, one in two will be able to keep those sort of things out. And that can be the difference over the course. You know, that game could very easily go on a very different way on Saturday.
Well, Fabianski has always been a very good shot stopper. It's just the rest of his goalkeeping has been very, very suspect, which is ultimately why he didn't make it at Arsenal at a time when we were desperately scratching around for goalkeepers.
Yes, anyone who's a second to Almunia isn't really doing them any favours, are they?
But I mean, it's also a case of looking at the goalkeeper market. I mean, you know, just this summer, Liverpool have spent the best part of 70 million on a goalkeeper that, until a year ago, was backup for Wojciech Szczesny, who was obviously deemed not at the standard of Arsenal by our previous leader.
Not at the standard from a footballing perspective?
Well, I mean, until Wenger writes his famous book, we'll never know, will we?
That decision still winds me up. Regular listeners will know I'm an ardent arsonist, as it were. But that is the one decision that almost single-handedly, I won't say turned me, but certainly made me revisit my feelings on the matter.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting, actually. I mean, this before we really move on to the match itself, this also deals with the issue of homegrown players. I mean, we're in a situation this year where we've had to sell Lucas Perez for next to nothing, because we haven't had enough homegrown players in the squad and relying on kids, essentially. You know, with the departures we've had in the last three years, we've lost Szczesny, Gibbs, Wilshire, I nearly said Ramsey, Oxlade-Chamberlain, who else? Walcott, yes. We've still got Carl Jenkinson. But in a league where homegrown players are having massively inflated value just so teams can meet their quotas, the fact that we've let so many go does sort of question a little bit of the strategic thinking at the club. Particularly, it certainly puts more pressure on the likes of Maitland-Niles and Reece Nelson to step up sooner rather than later.
Yeah, but I think we got ourselves into that situation because we aren't letting homegrown players go because we had too many homegrown players or because we're being short-sighted. Generally, we're letting them go because they've not been good enough. You know, Kieran Gibbs went to West Brom side but got relegated. You know, Jack Wilshere has gone to West Ham. He's not exactly been snapped up. I know he's a West Ham fan, but he's not been snapped up by one of Europe's elite. Oxlade-Chamberlain, okay, went to Liverpool, but still, Jory's still out there, isn't it? You know, he's the only one really of those names that you can sit here and say, was that a mistake? Yes.
Well, Theo's doing his best to suggest that under the right manager.
I said that when I left, didn't he? Put him in the right system. Put him, frankly, with just one player who is prepared to play an accurate ball over the top for him to chase, and he will score you 20 goals a season minimum.
Yes, Cesc Fabregas, we've never replaced you, even though Santi Cazorla is his best.
Santi Cazorla, you know.
So, I mean, looking at the match itself, bar the fact that obviously our high line is still deeply flawed and Mustafi still appears to be too stupid to be a top quality centre half, what other conclusions did either of you guys draw from it? What else stood out for you?
I saw a good wing play because I watched the highlights, the 15 minutes highlight, and there were a lot of wing play and crosses. So that was a positive for me.
Yeah, I mean, okay, well, picking up on that first, I mean, what do we think of this new tactic of playing Hector Bellerin as a wing back, even in a back four? I mean, we saw
that's a new tactic, Matthew. We've been doing that for years. It's just that we decided at some point that we should move him in five or three or whatever you want to call it because it wasn't working.
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, he's been largely left to cover the entire right flank on his own for the last two or three seasons. But it's clearly, how can we say, it's a greater focus of our attacking play at the start of this season has been trying to get Bellerin in than was the case certainly for the second half of last season. And it's obviously yielded results in an attacking sense, although leaving us more vulnerable defensively. I mean, do you think that is actually a tactical shift, or do you think it's just happenstance from a continuation of exactly what was going on before?
Yeah, I think it's two things. One is it's the left-hand side of our team is where attacks go to die. And that's not a new thing. That's been going on for years. You know, for all macroeconomic, for all the reputation Mato has for popping up with important goals, by and large, they are very much in the minority. And they are all the more surprising because he's so rarely involved in attack. Which means that by definition, they have to get more to compensate. And also, it just means that we're very, very predictable. You know, when the ball goes out to our left-hand side, it's pretty, you could be pretty confident that A, whoever's playing left wing, left midfield, whatever formation we're playing, is going to be tucked inside playmaking rather than out wide, you know, offering at the very least a quality of number, if not an advantage. And so the ball's going to come inside. Whereas as soon as it goes out the right, teams know that you're going to have Bellerin, you're probably going to have a winger out there as well, and possibly even a centre forward adding to the numbers.
Or Aaron Ramsey pushing out wide as well, yeah.
Exactly. So it becomes much easier to defend against when you know what's going to happen. And it's only because so far this season that Bellerin's crosses have actually connected with people, where in the previous sort of, I don't know, half a season we played, they were effectively going straight to the man who decided to drop in for the cutback rather than desperately dive to the 6-yard line. But we've had any success.
I mean, looking at that, I mean, here's a question for you, Sylvain. I mean, obviously, you've been calling for a left-sided winger, authentic winger, for about four seasons
now. The whole last season.
Well, for more than that, since we started doing this bleeding podcast. But
the footed winger, where is it?
Yeah. I mean, do you see there's a way that we can make that more equal with the players we have, or is it? Just something we have to accept for the time being, that we are going to be lopsided and more effective going down the right. And also, is it now a case where we're kind of Nacho, with his experience going also tucked in at centre half, is he sort of more likely to be in a more defensive role because he can cover across a little bit, which allows Bellerin to get further forward? I mean, I suppose the question is it a tactical choice, or is it just the fact that we don't have the players to make anything happen down the left?
Oof. It's a bit of both. We get too many right-footed players, obviously, on that side. So, and also, Nacho is not quick enough to go up and down as well. So, it's really difficult to get any speed on that side. It's true. So, we have to find other ways.
Yeah, I think he's also not bold enough, is he?
Yeah.
You know, you look, Bellerin's prepared to make the run and hope he receives the ball, whereas Nacho will only go if he knows the ball's coming. So, if he's the one that's laid it inside to then receive the ball beyond.
Yeah.
He's definitely more conservative in his mindset.
Yeah, it's definitely true that Nacho waits for a clear overlap, and generally when the ball's on the foot of Granit Xhaka to be spread wide, whereas Hector's, as soon as anyone's got the ball, Hector's looking to go. Which I suppose...
Even when we run up with 2 minutes to go.
Well, quite. But I suppose
that's how we scored the third goal, but... it's also West Ham nearly equalised.
Well, indeed. I mean, maybe that's also a partial reflection, though, of the fact that Bellerin started out his career as a winger, and Monreal's only time he's not played left back, he's played centre half.
I don't think Bellerin would fare all that well as a winger at the moment. He's very much in the Walcott mould of. All speed, no real skill. not that I'm saying he's an untalented footballer, but he's not into trickery. You know, he's all about his raw speed.
Yeah.
And as a player, too often that planner is blocked. It's only really effective when you're a fullback because the defence are already occupied by the winger.
Yeah, for sure.
Pushing for play winger, I don't think it works. Certainly not in the same way.
Yeah, it's why Walcott was much more effective when our tactic had our number 10 getting closer to our centre forward, because that would generally create more space in a wider position for him to burst into. I mean, looking elsewhere at the width and the balance of the team, we've got a bit of a conundrum up front, haven't we? Because obviously we've seen Aubameyang looking like his confidence is not quite where it was at the end of last season after some costly misses in the first couple of games. But then starting him in Lacazette.
Out at this point, Matthew. Anyone who has Aubameyang in their fantasy team, and I include myself in this, please take him out.
I removed him 2 weeks ago.
If you're an Arsenal fan with Arsenal players in your fantasy team, it never ends well.
I don't know. The last time I put
Theo instead, that's my advice.
The last time I put Theo Walcott in my fantasy team, it was a random punt because whoever I put in first scored about 18 goals.
Did it pay off, Matthew?
Sorry, what was that?
Did it pay off?
It did, actually. Yes, it paid off far better than I could.
Everton, then?
No, this was a couple of years ago. But in all seriousness, I mean, we've seen that Aubameyang, as we probably would have predicted, does not have the capacity to link play in the way that Lacazette does. But equally, we've seen that Lacazette doesn't have the pace to threaten him behind that Aubameyang does. And, you know, we've definitely looked more offensively threatening with the two of them on the pitch at once, but it does seem to bugger the balance of the midfield a little bit. I mean, what do you think the answer is going forward? Do you think it's the one-man system, or do we think it's this weird lopsided thing where we're playing sort of two strikers, but Aubameyang's normally on the left?
Well, I think there's no reason necessarily that Aubameyang is any worse in that position than Iwobi. It doesn't have to be less defensively solid, and I use that ironically rather than descriptively, I guess. I think we probably spent plenty of minutes on this very podcast talking about Iwobi's own deficiencies defensively last season.
Mm.
You know, they've not quite been as exposed this year so far. But he's not exactly renowned for his consistent and attended tracking back.
I mean, do we think this could potentially open the door for Danny Welbeck?
No.
Probably not, only as a sub.
No, I think Welbeck's best role is exactly what happened on Saturday, which is as a sub who can be brought on as additional firepower required if we want to start hoofing the ball in the box a bit more now that we've no longer got Giroud, or as someone who can come on and put in a shift on that left-hand side and get up and down and up and down a bit more. To me, when we replaced Aubameyang with Welbeck, although it's nominally left-like, that was a very, very defensive substitution, actually.
I mean, we've also got a conundrum in midfield as well, haven't we? You know, at the moment, and we don't know if it's just because of players being unavailable, but at the moment we seem to be Ozil or Ramsey. And it's hard to, you know, the balance of trying to fit them both in the team is something that Wenger never quite got his head around. And it seems like Unai Emery is also trying to work out what the order of priority is there and how best to balance it. I mean,
well, you have to wonder why he's gone with a four at the back, though.
Well,
four at the back allows him to cram in an extra body in the centre of midfield, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, and it's also, it's, you know, it, particularly with the absence of Koscielny, you'd be asking Rob Holding to come in and make a difference, and it's not to disparage Rob Holding, but then you'd merely having three okay defenders.
I've got to be honest, I'd rather have Rob Holding playing than some of the ones that are starting at the moment.
But my point being that
nothing personal with Mustafi, I just think he's a Rick waiting to happen.
I mean, I suppose the point I'm making is that the selection of midfielders we have, for all their flaws, are still better than the selection of our central defenders.
You can drop a central midfielder in defence, actually. But that might be a solution.
Who, out of our midfielders, who could do that?
El Nini,
yeah. So, who seems to have been loved up and then discarded over the course of pre-season.
My mum said that, though, when we were watching games. She said, "Oh, I'm really sorry for that guy, you know. What's his name? Nenny." close. You're nearly there in your attempt to be an Arsenal fan. But, you know, I think that was symptomatic of the fact that Elneny is a very good utility squad player, but he's not exceptional at any particular position. And so he's the kind of player that is never going to start in a team that's got aspirations, frankly, to finish top four, let alone to win the league. He's the Eric Dier of the Arsenal team. You know, a player who, if you need him to play, is, you know, solid and dependable, but he's never going to do anything especially sort of wowsers about it, you know?
Well, here's a question for you both, which is, on the evidence of what we've seen so far, what do you think the best Arsenal 11 is at the moment?
That's a good question.
Leno? Haven't seen him, but can he be worse?
Yeah, I mean, what do we reckon? I mean,
well, it's, for me, it's still Bellerin and Monreal. I don't think that's really up for debate. Are we ignoring injuries or are we talking available 11?
I think we have to talk available because it's undoubtedly Koscielny would be in our... I would probably... Well, assuming he gets back to the level he was, he would definitely...
An unknown quantity, isn't it? I have to say, I wasn't convinced he'd ever play for us again, but I'm rather too well acquainted with Achilles injuries myself.
Yeah.
So I don't have access to world-class surgery to fix it, so...
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in terms of available, I would probably play Holding and Socrates at the moment.
So, I don't
think Mustafi... For me, he's the kind of player that can look up to it, but over the course of a season will cost you. His mindset is not right, and he goes for things that aren't there, and he changes the way he plays based on the situation in the game. And I say that in a negative way. I'm not talking about playing the situation in the game in terms of managing the game. I mean in terms of, if we need a goal, he forgets that you still need to not concede a goal to catch up. And so he becomes reckless. And to me, that's not a good trait for a centre-back.
Yeah. Okay, and then the real question is midfield. Then what would you have in midfield? This is giving you time to think here, Sylvain.
Well, on the end of the first 3 games, I would have Torreira in that team.
Mm-hmm.
And I would probably play Aaron Ramsey in alongside him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would have probably Mkhitaryan, Ozil, Aubameyang and Lacazette.
So very similar to Wenger ball, suitably attacking. What about you, Sylvain?
In goal, check at the moment, but I'm sure Leno will come later in the season. So obviously Bellerin and Montreal, no real competition for them. Mustafi, Ellen is right, he's really low performing and very inconsistent. So who do we have? Socrates and
Holding or Mavropanos at the moment?
Who wants Mavropanos? Nah.
You play that one senior game, Sylvain.
Yeah. So I would have Torreira actually because he impressed me at the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
I would always have Ozil because he's a playmaker and I like playmakers.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I play 4-4-2 with Diamond because I like the 4-4-2 Diamond.
Mm-hmm.
So I have Ramsey on the right of the Diamond and on the left. Do we have any left-footed player?
Only Xhaka, I think.
Also Xhaka and up front, Aubameyang, Lacazette.
Yeah, I mean, I think I might...
Can you start with your Diamond, sorry?
Sorry? Xhaka on the left, Torreira at the bottom, Ramsey on the right, and Ozil at the top.
Yeah. So you picked the same players as me, but in a different shape, basically.
Yeah.
Almost.
You would check.
And also he's gone a midfield of Xhaka, Torreira, Ramsey, and Ozil. So no Mkhitaryan starting on the bench.
Yeah. Fair enough. I feel like I actually think Mkhitaryan had a pretty good game for us at the weekend. And I actually, the first 3 games, I think when we look dangerous, he tends to be the one that plays the first pass. He's not a player that I looked at last season and thought, yeah, he's, you know, necessarily first 11 quality consistently. But at the moment, I feel like he's performing in that way. So that's the only reason I really went for him.
Yeah, I mean, I do think...
I think Ainsley Maitland-Niles would actually have a stab at getting in my team if he was fit.
Well, yeah, it's very possible. I mean, I think it's going to take probably most of the season for the manager to really work out what his midfield is. I mean, does he want something which is solid and can move the ball well, whereas you've got Torreira and Xhaka and Ramsey and then a three-man attack along the lines of what Sylvain's talking about? Or is he going to want something which is going to offer more going forward in terms of supporting the front players? And it's a very difficult balance because we've got a squad full of specialists, but not that many. You know, that's one of the things that, for all his rawness and impetuosity, that has made Guendouzi catch the eye. So he's a player that is more of an all-rounder, in that he can distribute the ball well from deep, but he's also able to win the odd tackle. And in fact, his figures for tackles and interceptions have been very impressive.
As well, as he kept dropping in and filling spaces when people pushed forwards.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he does seem to be a player that is capable of playing more than one role, and obviously be having people who can do that in the match is very useful. And we've got quite a lot of players that Wenger has left us with who are really good at one or two things, but actually, if all the pieces aren't together in the puzzle, then the whole thing falls apart, in the same way that we didn't get close to having a title challenge once Santi Cazorla's Achilles went.
Exactly. One piece of the puzzle disappears and all of a sudden the picture is unrecognisable.
And you know, ultimately, we do need more players, not necessarily Matuei Guendouzi, perhaps of a higher standard, although who knows what he'll turn into, but players who can perform multiple roles on the pitch, because we're still in a situation where we've got a manager trying to fit the pieces together, but the pieces don't quite fit together because they're all too specialist in a way. You know, Ozil is obviously a brilliant playmaker, but he's never going to score you many goals and he's never going to win you many tackles. You got Ramsey, who's great at breaking into the box from midfield, but he's never going to sit and hold unless he's given very specific instructions to do so, because that's not his strength. Even the new signing, Torreira, he's not going to be able to break forward beyond the attacking players at any ever, so we know that he's a deep lying player. Xhaka has got no legs despite being a great distributor and having a decent shot in him. You've got all these players that have functions but very few multifunctional players, which is why I think Mkhitaryan could potentially be useful, because he's someone that can play the number 10 role and out wide genuinely in a way that Ozil can't play out wide. Despite the fact he sometimes gets put there just because people are like, well, you're good and we need to fit you in somehow.
But he doesn't get put there to play wide, though. He gets put there because he has to normally have a position, and he gets put there fully cognizant that he's going to be floating wherever he fancies.
But I still think it limits how much he floats when he's in a wider role, because you're not going to get him to propping up on the opposite flank. And one of his greatest strengths, I think, from a number 10 is about locating where space is and going to that space, which is why you see him popping up, you know, putting in crosses from the left wing or dropping deep onto the right or breaking into the box if all the strikers are outside the box. And I think if you play him on wide, it takes away half the pitch from him, which is diminishing his greatest strength. When we all talk about his passing and his imagination, but actually his greatest strength has always been about finding where there's space where he can hurt the opposition. And if you diminish what's possible to him, I think that you diminish his effectiveness as a player. And that's
the other thing is, it's spectacularly limiting for a player who is impressively one-footed.
yes.
And I say that with the greatest of affection, but I have no idea how someone reached his level whilst only being able to kick a football with one foot.
Yeah, but you know, Maradona is the same, Messi's the same.
Yeah. Well, it's that thing about left-footed players, isn't it? If they're good enough, it's that whole stereotype about having a sweet left foot or a left foot like a wand, you know. And most of them, their right foots are standing on. I mean, Messi has improved his right foot in the last three or four years, actually, quite a lot. But
I don't think he is as noticeably one-footed as Ozil is, for example.
No, certainly not.
Ozil will refuse to kick, to my mind, he's not the player he had the potential to be, because he sometimes makes decisions based on the fact he would have to pass it with his right foot.
Yeah.
He naturally opens up his vision to the side that he would pass to with his left.
Well, that's one of the reasons why people purr about him so much as a player, isn't it? Because he's capable of playing passes with his left foot, which are incredibly difficult, that actually, if he was right-footed, wouldn't be that hard.
No, absolutely not. To my mind, that we let Santi Cazorla disappear off to Spain this summer is a bit of a shame, because he's the kind of person that I would love to see in charge of our under-8s.
I think
I'm not ready to train our under-8s. I appreciate he wants to play, but he's the kind of player we should absolutely have involved at the bottom end of the club, developing players and teaching them the importance of being two-footed.
Ah, but we couldn't have denied him the opportunity of being unveiled by the Spanish David Blaine.
Yes, that was a bit special.
I mean, that had a level of crap theatricality, which is straight out of some sort of 80s talent show. I loved it. It was gorgeous. looking from what the evidence of the first three games, where do you see this team setting its realistic targets for this season? You know, do you think we actually are likely contenders for the top four, or do you think even that, with all the transition going on, is going to be difficult? Where do you sit on that, guys?
I'll be impressed if we finish top four, if I'm honest. I think the competition for that those Champions League places has never been higher. The business that the top teams have done in the summer, almost all of them have improved. Spurs have stagnated, but they were comfortably ahead of us, unfortunately.
Yeah.
At this point, I think I've seen positive changes at United, at Liverpool and at Chelsea. The weaknesses that were there before, I feel like they've, to a certain extent, targeted, which is a bit depressing. And we do have many weaknesses at the moment. I was sort of hoping that Emery would come in and give us a defensive platform to build from. You know, perhaps, you know, we've seen Wenger sides in the last 12, 18 months be blunted in order to focus on defensive stability. But I thought with a new manager, we might see that as a building block to then add the attacking flair back in. And I struggle to see us keeping many clean sheets this year. And we've seen before, if you go behind against these 11 men behind the ball sides who are significantly better at that than we are, it is a very awkward struggle, no matter how much attacking flair we've got. And I wouldn't say we are slick enough in attack to put those teams apart in a way that someone like Liverpool is.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's probably fair. I mean, what do you reckon, Sylvain?
Between fourth and sixth, basically. I think the team will improve slowly throughout the season, but yeah, probably not quickly enough. That might be the problem, because obviously Emery has to learn the Premier League and learn to know the players and everything. So,
yeah, I mean, it's set. From my perspective, the only way I can see Arsenal making top four is if the Mourinho effect of third season effect kicks in, which it's sort of trying to, but not very convincingly.
I could very well see a Mourinho implosion.
So we'd need
that, one of the two we need to drop out.
Yeah, we need that and a medium length injury to Harry Kane.
Yes, and even then, that's the depressing thing, isn't it? Even then, I'm still not sure I sit here and think we definitely finish above Spurs.
Well, it depends how medium length the injury is. I mean, I can't see your entry.
Yeah, but even if they didn't have him all season, I'm not convinced that, you know, obviously they would do significantly worse, but we weren't exactly close to them last year, were we?
True, but then he did score lots and lots and lots of goals and was the main attacking focal point for their team for two thirds of the season. I think he offers them. I mean, it's not going to happen. There's no point wishing for the injury of a single player. But it's. I mean, we're in this strange situation where Spurs still look like a well-oiled machine, but have very little in the way of squad depth outside of two or three positions. So it's kind of, yeah. Be interesting to see what happens there if they ever move into their own ground.
Nah. They're really bad, actually, on that point.
I mean, yeah, I suppose.
When you look at someone like Harry Kane, he has the similar. I'm not for a second likening him to someone like Messi, but the effect is similar in that teams go, oh crap, got to mark Messi, got to mark Kane, and that creates space for other players. You know, I remember vividly one game we played against Barcelona where we marked Messi out of the game.
But we forgot to mark anyone else.
4-0? That's the problem. You can nullify a player, but then you leave all sorts of gaps. If they're good enough, you leave all sorts of gaps for everyone else to exploit.
I mean, I suppose we're still very much seeing the embryonic stages of this team under this manager, so it's hard to know what other conclusions can draw at this point. So I wanted to kind of move on a bit and, Sylvain, I wanted to give, obviously you've been in France for the under-20 World Cup, or was it under-20 European Championships, I forget.
or the World Cup.
And obviously the Arsenal ladies are having a pre-season, which and the season is the squad looks in a good place. So, you know, give us a bit more of an update on both of those, if you could.
So the World Cup ended last Friday and England came back with a bronze medal, which was really good for the England girls.
It's the best at that age group they've ever achieved, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely, because last time I think they went to quarterfinal and that was their best ever. So it's actually very interesting because they basically played the same 11 more or less the whole tournament. Funnily enough, Mo Marley didn't make many changes, and she made like two changes in the 11 in the whole tournament. And one of them was like enforced because of a suspension. So it's kind of a bizarre thing to play like the whole tournament with 11 players and a few subs in and out. Mm. So it's a very interesting choice.
Were there any younger Arsenal players we should be looking out for?
No, we had none because they all left between 18 and 20. Nobody's getting a chance from the youth team, to be honest. So it's a complicated situation. All the academy players left, or 70% of them left during the transfer window. So it's quite complicated.
Mm. Well, it's been a complete change, isn't it? Because obviously Arsenal ladies were fantastic to produce their own players and still have a very high standard of academy. But again, it's that same problem that big clubs have, is getting youngsters to make the transition to a first team when there's three or four teams dominating the division and the standard so high.
Yeah, indeed. And we have the same home ground problem as the men's team, actually.
Yeah,
we have 25% home ground players, which is absolutely ridiculous when you think about it.
Well, particularly when you think that only three or four years ago, that it would have been the completely opposite way around.
Yeah. Basically, we got five homegrown players and out of 18, basically. The squad is really good in quality, there's no doubt, but nearly none of them are English, basically.
So looking at the squad, you know, there have been some new arrivals in the summer and some quite high-profile arrivals. Who should we be looking out for?
So we recruited the Austrian captain, who's unfortunately injured already.
We seem to do well without the new signings and the ladies.
Yeah, we got a Swiss player, defensive midfielder, who is really good, Lia Velti. Mm-hmm. Who else did we buy? Another injured player, Tabea Kemer, left back, who's really good as well, but still injured.
Mm-hmm.
And a French goalie, which is really nice because it's very easy to do interviews with her, actually.
That's the way you got your priorities right there, Sylvain.
Yeah. So she should be a backup for Van Vinindal. So we have a very high quality squad, but a very small in number because we only have 18. So we're very short of players at the moment.
Which is the opposite situation to what we had the last couple of years, isn't it? Where the squad's been quite bloated. I mean, obviously, Kim Little coming back to full fitness is a big plus, I think, for the season ahead. And our centre forward's been in great form in pre-season, hasn't she?
Yeah, Midima scored four against Juventus, so that was incredible. Actually, she was injured most of the season last year coming back from the Euros, so she wasn't sharp. And this year, she looks really sharp and quick. So we have a good chance of the title if the injured player come back very quickly.
And looking at those players who have departed, are there any players that have left that we should be really aware of? I mean, obviously, Alex Scott's retired. But who else has left the club? Of significance, you know, that we would know.
Alex left. Actually, not many left, if I remember well, actually.
So it was pretty much just the younger players on the fringes that left.
Yeah, more or less, because the coach wanted to reduce the number of players in the squad, obviously, because of the previous season problem. So, Isa O'Reilly left the American girl because she was wanted to go back to the US.
Yeah. And she's an older player, isn't she?
Yeah, she was. She's 32, so.
Mm.
But yeah, not many players left, like senior players. So the squad is good, and it's just the injuries level is a bit too high at the moment. But there's a very good hope this year that football will be good and we have a title chance.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen highlights from a couple of the preseason games, and certainly the newish manager seems to have the team performing at a high level, and there seems to be a good understanding. But it is interesting the parallel between the men's team and the women's team, in that the men's team has had quite a lot of young players leave this summer. You know, with people either choosing not to sign contracts, like last year, Chris Woolock decided to go to Benfica. This year, we've had Steffi Mavididi move to Juventus, of all places, for £2 million. And Josh De Silva has decided to not sign a new contract and moved to Brentford. And we had a younger academy player, the excellently named Armstrong Okoflex, who's half Irish, half Nigerian. He moved to Celtic. You know, so the issue is an issue in both men's and women's football at Arsenal, of players who can't see an immediate pathway leaving. But at least it looks like Reece Nelson is either signed or it's all sorted out that he will be imminently signing a new contract, because obviously his contract was running out and is possibly the jewel of our academy, as his early form in the under-23s shows him Smith Rowe and Nketiah are really the names we're looking out for on that front. And you know, in the same way with someone like Leah Williamson for the women's team, it's about those younger players and making sure that the real cream stays.
Yeah, definitely. But it's, as always, it's really difficult for a young player to come through when the quality is high in the first team. So it's hard to find the right balance, to be honest.
Moving on, I'm just going to... There's a couple of things I want to very quickly talk to you guys about, and it will be very... Yeah, it won't take us long, but I haven't had a chance to speak to either of you about the Ozil situation. I mean, obviously, I've been banging on about it at length, but I thought it was interesting that the report that came out today, that there was a big split within the actual German camp between the multi-ethnic heritage players and the Bayern Munich, for want of a better way of putting it, Teutons. Apparently, with the non-German ethnic players being known as Kanake, or which effectively means wog, and the white German players being called a potato,
like the Spurs.
Yeah, well, I mean potato, because obviously anyone that's been to Germany and eaten the food knows that there's a lot of potatoes in the diet. It's interesting that certainly all the Bayern players, bar Jerome Boateng, who've been lining up to take kicks at Özil in the press, were all came into the, shall we say, the non-sympathetic to the ethnic minorities camp. I mean, without going into any great depth about it, what did you guys make of the situation? Do you think there's any... Is it just that Özil was poorly treated, or do you think there's more to it than that?
Well, I think we'll never know exactly what goes on behind closed doors. You know, we've only got a bit of he said, she said, really, to go on. It's difficult, isn't it? Because, I mean, I play in a netball team, which is based in Tottenham. And for those of you who live in the UK, you'll be aware that the communities around Tottenham tend to have quite a lot of people who... at some stage in their heritage have come from a lot of the Caribbean islands. And the consequence of that is that at my netball club, I am referred to as the white girl. In the most affectionate manner possible. But those people are very proud of their heritage. And indeed, a couple of those girls are currently playing for the Caribbean islands that their family came from in an international netball competition, despite the fact that they are, you know, fundamentally British nationals. And I think we live in a world where mixed identities are just part and parcel of life now. Very few people are one thing through and through, and even if they are, it doesn't really matter. Or they might just be in denial, frankly, about the their own heritage, just because it's not as blatantly obvious because it's recent history, or it's blatantly obvious because of appearances, rather than just name or identity. So it feels like it's a bit naive to divide people quite so evenly into two boxes like that. You know, inevitably there are people that see the world as black and white. But Germany is a country that holds itself up as someone who welcomes people from other heritages. And to my mind, you can't, on the one hand, claim to be open and accepting and welcoming of people who come from different backgrounds, but then expect them not to also acknowledge and frankly be proud of their own backgrounds. Anyone from anywhere, you know, there are pros and cons of any nationality, any heritage, any identity. And you don't, you know, I don't sit here and say I'm not proud to be British because of our colonial history, or, you know, there are so many things that every nationality has done wrong over the course of its history. And that's just something you have to deal with. No individual generally is responsible for the actions of an entire nation anyway.
I mean, obviously, Sylvain, you know, like me, you're someone of a slightly more complicated ethnic background. I mean, it's hard to know where to even begin with all this stuff, but obviously, it seems that the whole issue that it seems to be, is it about Özil the player, or is it about an issue about people wishing multiculturalism to be something that is only accepted with conditions? I mean, what conclusions did you draw?
You know, it's the same in France, for example. There's some, when Yannick Noah was playing tennis, they used to say when he wins he's French, when he loses he's Cameroonian. So it's stuff like that does happen. So it's really complicated. I'm quite sure there was some pressure on Ozil, and he didn't feel he was backed up at all. I got no doubt about it. So and his teammates, actually, the Bayern guys, they probably didn't think there was a problem either. So,
well, I mean, that's it. I mean, of course, if you're in a situation where a minority feels that they are not being treated fairly, it's often very difficult for those who are not part of the minority to understand where they're coming from.
It's a complex problem, huh?
Like I was saying that my Neville club called me the white girl. Can you imagine if in my other Neville club, which is based in the home counties, you know, we actually don't really have anyone I can think of who's not what we would describe as white British. We had someone in that club who we sat and called, you know, the black girl or the Asian girl. Can you imagine the uproar? And, you know, I don't take offence because they don't mean it that way, and I'm not particularly sensitive in any case. But that is probably symptomatic of a society that's very intolerant at times of different people of different ethnic backgrounds, that force them to be more defensive in that way, more sensitive to be, I guess, identified or singled out on that basis.
Well, it's. I mean, as you say, Sylvain, the complexity is exactly due to what Helen's describing, which is when something which is a pure descriptive term becomes a pejorative term at different points in history, it's going to take a long time for that in not to carry that weight. And of course, as you rightly identify, it would be the case if you started pointing people out because of they were black, or in Germany because someone is of Turkish heritage, particularly with the relations between Turkey and Germany as they are at present.
It's the same sentiment that's led the UK to the situation it's in now. You know, I live near Stansted Airport, where inevitably, because it's an international hub, there's a lot of people of different nationalities here. But you still hear the rhetoric about, you know, immigrant, not so much here, but you know, the nationwide rhetoric around immigrants and people taking jobs and so on and so forth. You could, I don't agree with it. I don't hold that view myself, but I can still see why it's happened, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, you
know, why people are using what should be descriptive terms as labels.
I mean, I find it very interesting because obviously being someone who is culturally about as British as you can bloody get, but yet still has blood from all over the planet, I find the whole concept of differentiation for anything other than, you know, basic identifiers as being slightly beyond me. But that's the consequence of having been someone from, you know, a mixed family growing up in London who is very... what you describe as culturally assimilated. So therefore I have no sense of internal conflict, and I'm not often confronted with conflict because, you know, I'm only a bit brown and I'm sort of so fucking British that even the most racist people find it hard to be hard to be unpleasant to me, and then they get it wrong anyway. So yeah, the whole kind of, I guess for me, it's a sort of why do we still see immigration as an issue, and what does that say about a particular society? I mean, obviously, we could talk for 3 hours about right-wing politics and the nature of
nationalism.
People
who are different, though.
But that's only because they're in condition not to, you know. Obviously, you know, I live in London where, frankly, if there's a nationality you don't meet, you're doing quite well. And so, therefore, it's very hard for most of the city to hold those kind of views because of just exposure, in the same way that kids don't view those things. They might ask, why is that person got a brown face?
It's also a numbers thing, isn't it?
Of course.
You don't really have a particular majority, then it's not a problem to be in a small group because everyone's a small group. Well, if you go somewhere where you pick out like a sore thumb, it's a completely different completely different situation. And that's why I say, where I live, there's a lot of people of different nationalities, and it's quite accepted because there's no, you know, there's no strong feeling against, I don't know, the Polish people or the Romanian people, whoever, you know, all the groups that you hear about in the press that people hold vendettas against. But I can well understand why in other parts of the country where you have particular groups that move to particular areas, you know, I can understand why people identify them with specific things, even if I don't understand why people are so negative towards them.
Of course, the great irony being that the larger the individual group is, the quicker people get used to it. But anyway, again,
they probably assimilate themselves.
Yeah, it's a very complicated issue. But I just thought, you know, as it's something which keeps coming up in the press every day, every second day, I wanted to touch base with you guys about it. And the last thing I wanted to ask, just before we wrap up, is: did any of you get to see which was a remarkably interesting, particularly given who it was, Michael Owen talking about his injury experiences and the way it affected his career on the thing that was on BT Sport that was been pigging around the internet?
I haven't seen the full video.
Yeah, it's a 9-minute stuff. It's quite interesting, but especially when he says after breaking his hamstring. Whatever, he just lost his pace and he had to change his game.
And also, particularly, I found quite interesting, and I think it's a really useful reminder for football fans that he said, you know, he realised that he'd been this player for all his life, and then suddenly he couldn't be that kind of player anymore, and he had to work out how to be a different kind of player. But so then was no longer putting him in himself in the positions where he had previously been effective, because he knew he could no longer be as effective in those positions without risking serious injury. And I think it's very, you know, as football fans, we players get injured, they come back, and we expect so much because we expect them to relatively quickly fulfill those memories of what they were, without realizing that a player can still comparatively stay fit for a long period of time, but still be fundamentally changed in the way that, you know, obviously Michael Owen's a fantastic case in point. I mean, everyone could see the difference between him until he was about 24, 25, and the player he was afterwards. But also, you know, Jack Wilshere being a case in point for that all Arsenal fans, we can identify that his injuries took away that little element that made him be more than just good, or occasionally very good, into a truly special player. And I think it's very important that we remember that when we're looking at Koscielny's impending return. I would certainly recommend anyone who remembers Michael Owen as a player and is interested in football to, if you get a chance, catch the video, because the way he talks about it is extremely candid, extremely honest, and quite sort of revealing into the mindset that a player and the change the changes in that mindset that a player is going through, that kind of enforced change on their career. So I just really wanted to flag that up, because I thought it was a really good piece of TV, and given that Michael Owen is no one's favourite pundit on this podcast, it was nice to see a situation where actually, when he's talking about his own life and his own experiences, he can be quite interesting and insightful.
Found it quite sad in places, actually.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's kind of partly why it made an impact on me. I wanted to, because it was quite emotional in a way, even though he was talking about it quite matter of fact.
I did like his stats at the start though, about how he reckoned he'd played the same number of games or more than Rooney, Scholes, Giggs, Gerrard, etc. at the same age, and then you dig down into the numbers and actually not even close.
Well, yeah, not compared to certainly Giggs or
no, but he was saying by age 22 he played as many or more games. No, actually incorrect.
Yeah.
Not really relevant to the point you were making. More relevant to the fact that he's not very good at statistics.
Yeah, well, indeed.
Anyone who's listened to his punditry and commentary will know.
Well, that's it, yeah. Perhaps it's a reflection of the fact that when he's talking about his own experiences, it's rather more compelling than when he's trying to talk about things in an analytical fashion from a removed perspective.
Yeah, by all means, talk about how you feel and how that's affected your game. Don't try and assess others. But I think you mentioned Koscielny, and that for me is a worry, because in a defence devoid of pace, he's always the one player we've had who did have a little bit of speed. And if he loses that going forwards, then you have to sit here and think we are more than one centre-back short of a defence.
Mm. Yes, it's true. I mean, I think most Arsenal fans would probably recognise that. I mean, at some stage, unless Chambers suddenly has a wonder spell at Fulham, at some stage we are going to need to buy another centre-back.
Also slow.
Sorry?
Also slow.
Yeah, well, I just mean in terms of numbers, let alone specific.
Yeah, my issue is, you know, you look at someone like John Terry. John Terry got through an entire career of being slow by reading the game very well. Mm. But he didn't do that by having another slow centre-half alongside him.
No, indeed. He had pre-insanity William Gallas. Okay, last thing, just before we wrap up. We're away at Cardiff at the weekend. What do we think? Scoreline predictions. It's a 1:30 kickoff.
Can you tell me anything about Cardiff?
They got promoted. Neil Warnock is their manager.
Yeah,
they play a fairly rudimentary style of football. They haven't really spent much money on players at all. They've got quite a weak squad, but they have drawn two of their first three games, so are predictably resilient.
Lovely. Just the kind of side we're going to do well against, though.
Yes.
To be fair, if there's very little opposition, then we've got a chance.
Key thing, I think, is probably, as it always is, if we score first, we should be okay. Simply because Cardiff...
Matthew, have you watched Arsenal in the last 2 years?
No, but Cardiff don't...
be true.
they don't have the greatest strength going forward, with all due respect.
Yeah, in the last 2 years, it's been a case of if we score first, we might draw. If we concede first, we'll probably lose.
Ah, but this is the new era.
And I have definitely got a distinct feeling of deja vu watching us play.
Okay.
I got quite excited after the City and Chelsea games, actually, because although the results were predictable, I felt like the performances were different enough that they offered some potential.
Mm.
And then watching the West Ham game, I've watched this game a million times before, and somehow it's ended well for us, but I'm not quite sure how.
Okay, well, give us a scoreline prediction. Go on.
Oh, whatever. 3-0.
Yeah.
1-0.
Home win.
Sylvain's gone for 1-0. I'm going to go for 2-0. I think it'll be our first clean sheet of the season, although it'll be by luck rather than judgment. And I think Aubameyang will finally get a goal.
Please, yes. And once he gets one, he's having a Harry Kane August, isn't he? And we can't be doing with that.
No. Although Harry Kane again tonight has just proved that he's no longer having a Harry Kane August. I mean, it's a typical one, because obviously we don't like to see Spurs win, but it is quite funny to see Man United lose at home. So it's currently Manchester United 0, Tottenham Hotspur 2. Obviously, by the time you listen to this, listeners, you will know the final result and will know if United have managed to storm back against all odds. But at the moment, it looks like apparently Spurs should have scored a couple more chances because Man United are in danger of imploding.
I can hear Lewis now crying in the other room then.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least if it continues as it is, then your fella will be in a good mood for the rest of the night, so you can take that one.
Yeah, we're not watching it live, so I've got that pleasure to go in and watch after this.
Oh, great, lucky thee.
Yeah, he's watched approximately 10 minutes of it so far.
Okay, well, you know something that he doesn't then, perhaps.
Yeah, I'll have to keep my mouth shut and busy myself.
I was going to say, yeah, you find a way to keep yourself occupied.
Go in and look miserable, he'll know that I know the school, so.
Oh, just make sure that your arrival is you know, distracted by baby or something.
Yeah, I was thinking the other day about Man City and how it feels like they're pretty much nailed on to win the title. And their last, this was pre-Wolves, by the way, and the last time I checked, the odds of them doing so were 8-13 on. So if for every pound that you committed, I think it was £1.61 you got back, including stake.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I'm not sure that, I mean, I'm naturally a very risk-averse person anyway, but even though I feel that they're pretty nailed on, I'm not sure that's a good bet.
No, it's not really.
The upside for the downside is not really there for them.
It's not really worth the effort. You're better off betting on the championship.
Well, you have to bet quite a bit of money to make it worth it.
Yeah.
And then, as I say, the downside is significantly worse than the upside. So, yeah, I was thinking about it. I would actually quite like City to win the title. And I say that slightly painfully, because at this stage of the season, I'm completely in denial. I only say things like, oh, well, you know, a few injuries here and there. If we can get one of the games going, you know, things will click. Yeah, whatever. The reality is, of the top six teams, excluding us, City are the least of all evils. And I sit here and think, well, if City winning the title means that Spurs or Man U or Liverpool or Chelsea don't win it, I guess I'm kind of okay with that. And that's quite an odd feeling.
Well, it's also that no one can deny that they bought it. I mean, yeah. I was doing,
not that they made it any better when Chelsea did it.
I mean, I was doing this thing of the last 10 years transfer net spends, and the last 10 years Man City have spent as much as Arsenal, Liverpool, Spurs and Chelsea combined.
Chelsea?
Yeah. Because you've got to remember, wow. The last few years.
I think they spent a lot of money early on and then sort of tailed off a bit.
Well, also, transfer fees have massively exploded, Chelsea have stopped spending quite so much. Whereas Man City, you know, I mean, we were all really impressed when they turned us and rolled us over in the first game. But then when you realise, you're thinking, oh, they've got loads of players missing, you know, wow, it's really impressive. And then you think, oh, yeah, but even so, their third choice left back is still like 50 million quid.
Yeah, their third choice left back still would walk into our team.
You know, so it is every so often you're reminded of the absolute obscenity of it, and you know, but we'll talk about that more in a future podcast, because I've did an interview with Joe O'Dell for the campaign for human rights in the United Arab Emirates, who of course that affects Arsenal as sponsors, but we do know that entire region has a very interesting impact on football at the moment, so we'll keep our powder dry on that one. Before we divulge into even more political discussion. So with that in mind, I think it's time for us to knock it on the head. This has probably gone on quite long enough. Helen probably needs to go to bed, or at least find ways to avoid her Spurs-supporting husband. Are you working tomorrow, Sylvain?
Yeah, I'm back in business after 2 weeks off, so it's going to be fun.
Yeah, so you'll be busy, and I've got to be up at the crack of dawn pretending to be a lawyer. So there we go. So with that in mind, have a splendid week, one and all.
I'm singing Wimpy Spider. Oh, how life has changed.
Well, at least your repartee of songs will have developed.
Yeah, Lewis's favourite sound at the moment is good, 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 good. So me and my dad have consistently been going, good, 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 Guna.
Yeah, yeah. And then you start doing it in the rhythm, and hopefully one day, before he even knows what it means, he'll be Utu being along with the rest of us.
Exactly. How young do you reckon they let them in at the Emirates?
I've seen some pretty tiny babies in there before. I don't think there's a particular limit.
I guess it comes down to whether you want to spend £1,500 for someone who's got no idea what's going on.
Well,
actively, like, take away from your own enjoyment of the.
Well, I think that's more the issue. Yeah. All right, one and all. It's time to knock this on the head. We've been going for a while. Thank you for bearing with us if you got this far. Hopefully it's been worth it. I think it's been quite an interesting meander through the topics of Arsenal and wider football. We'll be back again next week. Thanks again for joining me, Sylvain.
Thank you.
And thanks again to Helen.
You're welcome.
And her special guest star, who, of course, will be a pod regular in the future, whether he wants to be or not.
Inadvertently or otherwise.
Exactly. And if you want to get in touch with us, drop us a line at Daily Cannon Pod on Twitter with your questions, your recommendations, your investigations for us, or indeed just comments about my face. On that note, have a lovely week. I don't know, they can't see my face, but they can imagine.
Voice. I feel voice would be more appropriate for a podcast.
Possibly, but I think
people don't know. Matthew has a very fetching ponytail.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm suggesting my face has more comic potential than my voice. Anyway, have a good week, one and all, and let's hope we beat Cardiff at the weekend. Cheerio.
Yeah.